The hour of recess has expired. The Senate is now back in session. Senator from Newton.
Thank you, Mr. President. Without objection, the Senate will go to the order of business. The order of business, the Senate bills for perfection. I would ask you recognize the senator from the second on Senate Bill 1.
Seeing no objection, we will go to that calendar. The senator from the second.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that Senate Bill number 1, with the Senate substitute and the amendment pending, be brought before the body.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. Senator from the second.
I do believe that the senator from St. Louis County has an amendment pending. Is that correct?
That is correct. And when we had the bill laid over, the senator from the first had the floor. Senator from the first, you are recognized.
Thank you. I believe I was inquiring or finishing my inquiry of the of one of the senators who had been in this body in 2005, the last time we took this up. I think that I was just about wrapped up with my questions, and so I will have a seat.
Further discussion? Senator from the 11th, for what purpose do you rise?
Mr. President, I'd like to inquire the senator from the 13th.
Senator from the 13th. Senator from the 13th. Senator from the 13th, do you yield? She does. Proceed.
Senator, I think we're on your amendment, right?
We are.
And I think what you were doing, if I remember correctly, is you were removing part of the part of the bill. You were kind of getting rid of something you found objectionable to that, right?
I was.
I'm trying to find my example.
I was removing the language from the bill that would put occupational diseases in this bill.
Okay.
And I was removing occupational diseases from the bill. Does that refresh your memory, Senator?
Yes, yes, I appreciate that, and you gave me a little time to find this. But I think what the senator from the first had a long discussion with different people, the senator from Nottoway, the senator from the second, about what happened in 2005, and seems to be a dispute still. Was occupational diseases supposed to be part of 2005 or not, because previously it was part of the workers' comp second injury fund. Is that correct? Is that how we...
That's correct.
Okay.
That's where we were. You were there in 2005.
Well, you know, I was really worried that the senator from first was going to inquire me because I don't remember. When I was in the House, I, you know, bad bills would come up, I'd vote no and move on with my life. And so I'm interested in this new perspective
now,
here.
You're in a smaller body now, Senator. The spotlight is on you.
Yes, the spotlight is on me, but what we should try to do in the Senate is make the bills better. And I think that's what you're doing with your amendment, Senator, because we have a problem that has been articulated very well by the senator from the second, is that we don't have enough money in the second injury fund. But now we have part of the bill that's trying to solve that problem, but then the other part of it trying to add other things to it. It doesn't seem to make sense to have both in there because we're only expanding the second injury fund.
I agree, Senator. If we're going to fix this, which I think everyone in this body agrees, that the second injury fund needs to be repaired.
Mm-hmm.
It's broken. It's badly broken. But I don't think that adding things to the bill for certain business interests repairs the bill. All we're doing is starting to turn this into a Christmas tree.
Right, and we're adding on more to the second injury fund, even though we're trying to repair it at the same time. It doesn't seem to make sense with the original purpose of trying to fix it. And Senator, you told stories of people that you worked with who have had occupational diseases. Tell me, what happens to them now? Currently, since they're not in the second injury fund, what do they do for their remedy?
Well, it's not necessarily second injury fund. They will no longer have the ability to go to court. They will have to settle for whatever they are offered through workman's compensation.
Mm-hmm. But right now, they're able to go to the court.
Yes.
and they're able to go to a judge and say, you know, I'm injured, I have this disease, it was related to my work, and then the judge decides if a business has any liability there. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think the senator from the first described it pretty well. It's a little bit more difficult when you go to court to prove your case. Hmm? In fact, sometimes it's a lot more difficult. But the benefits for yourself and your family are probably, you're better compensated.
Hmm?
And I don't know. What do you think is a fair price for someone's life?
I'm getting at is what the fair thing to do is to keep it to where someone who feels like they're injured can go to a court. Because I tell you what, Senator, just because they go to a court doesn't mean it's always going to be ruled in their favor.
Well, that's true too, Senator.
Many times it's ruled into the business's favor financially. So we see, and we're concerned about workers, and we're concerned that we want to make sure that they're taken care of, and the court should be the remedy, but sometimes it doesn't work that way. They don't have the facts behind them. So it seems as though we're adding occupational disease to this bill to help businesses so they don't have to go through the court, but in truth, sometimes the court is okay for businesses. I guess that's the point I'm trying to make
here. Well, and I can't remember 2005 either, all of it, but there was some discussion of that in 2005, if you recall. Oh, that's right. You don't recall.
I don't recall. I don't recall.
I can understand that. I find it difficult sometimes to recall last month.
I understand. And I think the purpose of my inquiry is that we should support your amendment, because then what we have done is that we've separated two different issues. We've allowed us to proceed to solve the problem that I really do believe. And I liked what you said about the 34 of us being genuine in our motives. I really do believe that the senator from the second has taken, seeing the problem, and is really trying to solve the problem that we have with the second injury fund. I think your amendment makes it even stronger and lets us focus on solving that problem and moving on, and then we can deal with
occupational diseases can
happen in the way it happens now.
I was very sincere about that comment, but being genuine, I think everybody comes here with purpose, and I don't think anybody, when they do something in this body, is trying to slide one. Well, I won't go that far.
Well, since you said that, I thought maybe I should begin to adopt that. So I think you're sincerely going to try, with your amendment, you're sincerely trying to separate something out, sincerely trying to help solve the problem that the senator from the second is trying to do.
Well, if we genuinely want to fix the second injury fund,
yes,
let's fix the second injury fund.
Right.
Okay? Let's not complicate it or compound the issue by putting other things in it. The original bill did not have this in it. The substitute did.
Right.
And that's when all the scurrying started.
Right.
So I think we were all kind of on the same page, not necessarily we were in the same chapter, not on the same page before. But then when this got put on there, everybody started running around.
Well, I thank you for the inquiry, and thank you for your amendment. It's a good amendment. It helps not only workers, but also helps us move forward to solving the problem that is that we clearly see with the second injury fund.
Senator, I appreciate it, and I appreciate your support. Thank you.
Further discussion. Senator from the 14th, for what purpose do you rise?
Thank you. I'd like to inquire of the senator from the 1st.
Senator from the 1st. Senator from the 1st, the senator from the 14th would like an inquiry. Do you yield?
Do you yield?
He does. Proceed.
Thank you so much, Senator. I know that you've been asking questions around about what happened in 2005, so I thought I would do a little research. It was also in 2005, the Senate Bill 1, where we dealt with workers' compensation. It was then sponsored by Senator Loudon. The bill was referred to Small Business and Insurance and Industrial Relations, and it looks like March 30th of 2005, Governor Blunt signed that legislation. I also decided to look in the Journal of the Senate and also look at the Journal of the House as to who voted for this bill. So in the Senate, you know, none of the members who were in the Senate in 2005 are here anymore, but you know, one of my favorite senators who's a lobbyist now, I can't say his name, but you know, he voted in favor of this. Then our Attorney General voted in favor of this workers' comp bill in 2005. I have to refer to the House, who in the House, who's now in the Senate. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 people who are currently in this Senate body who voted for Senate Bill 1 in 2005.
Wow, that's more than I realized.
Yes, and the folks who are in the Senate currently who voted against Senate Bill 1 from 2005, there are four of us. Myself, the senator from the 9th, the senator from the 11th, and the senator from the 13th. So I decided to do a little bit more gathering of information just so we can try to have some clarification of what happened in 2005. And I don't know who represents Sedalia, but this fine person wrote a letter to, he's from Sedalia, his name is John Boyd, and he wrote a letter to Governor Blunt, and I'd like to read it to you. He wrote it to Governor Blunt on March 29th, 2005. Would you like me to read this to you so you can have some kind of you know, viewpoint of what this person from Sedalia said about the legislation that the governor ultimately signed on the next day?
Well, it's your inquiry, and I'm happy to defer to your mode of questioning. I will note anecdotally, and hopefully not unduly, in an unduly arcane manner, there actually is one member of the Senate who was also a member of the Senate in 2005, and that is the president of the Senate, our lieutenant governor. I'm happy to answer whatever question you want to ask me, however you want to phrase it.
Well, I just want you to listen to this letter that was written by a person from Sedalia. I don't know who represents that area because I don't know that part of the state very well. So it says, "Dear Governor Blunt, I write to you with the request that you veto this legislation and that you return it to the General Assembly so that it may fix a monumental disaster in the making if left intact. Here is the problem. The fiscal note attached to the bill demonstrates that the income stream for the second injury fund will be decreased by two events of significance. One, the annual surcharge will be capped at 3%, and two, the rate of collections are reduced by 10%. As your staff pointedly illustrate, this depletes the second injury fund from a financially viable position it has maintained since its inception during World War II, to one of intolerable ruin. Here are the details, which I quote verbatim. The projected rates for the second injury fund surcharge were 4.5%, 5.5%, and 6.5% in fiscal years 2006, 7, and 8, respectively. Capping the rate at 3% would reduce receipts by almost $28 million in 2006, $46 million in 2007, and $65 million in 2008. In addition, the proposal would reduce collections from 110% of their previous expenditures to 100%. This would generate less income for the fund. Considering just this change and no other factors, the fund would be periodically in deficit for fiscal year 2007. The second injury fund has protected employers, disabled workers, and the survivors of workers killed in the line of duty when their employers commit fraud by not purchasing insurance. It has provided protection to employers, encouraged the hiring of handicapped heroes of military service and disabled citizens. There is no justification to place all of those parties at risk because of the improvidence of the unintended consequence of bankrupting this worthwhile program. Here's an example of how everyone wins with the program financially solvent. Employers are encouraged to hire the handicapped because they know with such protections in place, a Missouri veteran who suffered a loss of sight in Iraq and then loses sight in the unimpaired eye has a result of a work-related accident would be able to receive payment for the effect of combining those losses from the second injury fund and not the employer. The veteran wins initially because of finding work while profoundly disabled and thereafter is assisted with income replacement for the total disability. Within your first term, you would witness the bankruptcy of this program, something which protects employers and employees alike. By vetoing this measure on this basis alone, you will send a message of fiscal responsibility to the General Assembly, which it will have time to repair. While time will tell what savings to Missouri employers are passed on by the balance of the changes in Senate Bill 1 and 130, it makes the most financial sense to be fiscally responsible until we know what those savings will be. Just because these current surcharges can be levied at different rates does not require the levies to be at a maximum amount. Rather, the discretion of your cabinet officials to exercise fiscal responsibility remains best protected by your veto. On behalf of the citizens of Missouri, in my capacity as counsel to the Missouri AFL-CIO, I guess that's what that is, I write to you and request your attention, your action in this manner. Should your staff desire supplementation, I would be honored to provide you with such information required. Now, I would call that a red alert, a red flag, an opportunity.
Well, it certainly proved ultimately to be quite sagacious in terms of the ultimate effect of Senate Bills 1 and 130 as passed in 2005. There might have been more than one thing that was prognosticated in that letter that did not prove to be true, but the only one that caught my attention was, I think it was actually perhaps not within 4 years, but shortly after 4 years that most of what that letter predicted came to be true. But otherwise, I would say that sounds pretty spot on to me.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting how you research and you look at old information, public information, and you realize that someone kind of had a clue of what would happen now. Now we're dealing with it. So I have some other documents. I had the librarian. You know, today I had a bunch of librarians in my office. I love librarians. And it just so happened I went to my assistant and I said, go down to the librarian on the third floor, and I want all the details, all the articles dealing with the second injury fund from 2005, because evidently, you know, none of us know or remember our history from 2005. And I would just like to be reminded of what happened in 2005. So, I mean, I have articles here. I just wanted to read that letter to you because it was so pointed. And it was so evident that, you know, we would be in this position right now. But, you know, I had a wonderful visit. You know, if you ask for something, you'll get it. So I said earlier that no one's been knocking on my door to talk to me about occupational disease. And it just had to be, I don't know, fate or something, where mysteriously, out of the blue, one of my constituents from my district decided to come to my office and give me the history of occupational therapy. Now that I know the history of occupational therapy and what happened in 2005, I think this is going to be quite a ride tonight. And, you know, I don't know if you know the history of it even. Did you know, Senator, that the folks who put Senate Bill 1 together in 2005 made a mistake?
I'm sorry. The question is, did I know the folks that put...
Did you know that the people who put together Senate Bill 1 and 130 made a mistake that we haven't talked about yet on this floor today?
I'm not sure I know what you're referring to. Of course, some earlier today characterized the change in occupational disease that was subsequently deemed to have occurred pursuant to that change in the law to have been an unintended mistake, and I think that's part of what you were just getting at as to whether it was or not, but it sounds like you may be talking about something else.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. That's why I was saying yesterday you need to, like, review this stuff so you know what you're talking about. And, you know, obviously I didn't know anything much about this, just the surface level. And I talked to the senator from the 13th about that. And, you know, I took my time out from my family to study this bill and the second injury fund this weekend because I wanted to know more about it. And in learning about it, you know, I kind of became a little bit passionate because I saw the inequality that poor people would have to face if anything ever happened to them, the way that this bill happened, and they'd have to seek resolution through this proposed legislation. But going back to occupational therapy, so in the late 1920s, we adopted an amendment to the Constitution where we created workers' comp. I think the senator from the 15th talked about 80 years of legislation, and, you know, we're going to have to carefully sift through this. And so in the 1930s, then you have the addition of occupational therapy or occupational disease. Now, in the 1930s, we didn't have the technology or the know that you can get cancer from certain jobs that you had. People didn't know having overexposure to asbestos would cause cancers. No one knew about that. And there's something called cyclica. No one knew in the 30s about these things happening because of their working conditions and their environment. So then, about 20, 30 years, and then in the 1970s and 80s, people started, after 30, 40 years of working in an industry, they started developing cancer, mesothelioma, and other things. So the compensation was only about $5,000, right? So, Senator, I want you to just imagine for a second, from the 1930s up until 2005, people who had an occupational disease had no resolve because their issue was underneath workers' comp. And you didn't have, under workers' comp, you're basically saying that you don't have access to a jury. You can't go through, can't become whole again by going through workers' comp because there was no jury. So all of a sudden, and here's the mistake. I say all of that, Senator, to tell you about the mistake. It's funny, too. It's just really funny. After 85 years of us having a workman's comp, workers' comp language in our statute, in our Constitution, after 75 years of having occupational disease defined in statute in our Constitution, 2005 came, and boy, I have all these quotes in here, even from members who currently serve in the Senate, all of these quotes in here. And guess what happened? This is what's funny. After 85 years, there was a mistake in Senate Bill 1, and 130 that finally allowed those people with occupational disease to seek to become whole through the judicial system. Isn't that amazing? It's a mistake they made. But in our eyes, and I don't want to make the assumption for you, but I'm certainly going to say on behalf of myself, is that that mistake allowed so many people to have the opportunity to become whole again.
Well, and the inquiry that I engaged in right before we broke earlier this morning was really intended to try to discern whether, in fact, it was a mistake, whether this was an intended change in the law or not. And we heard several people say that it was unintended. We heard some say that folks had been warned at the time. You just read a letter from the AFL-CIO's general counsel at the time, making it very clear of the issue. And, I don't know. I wasn't here. And I don't know whether this was an intentional public policy change or not. And, of course, you had 163 people voting in the House and 34 in the Senate and the governor signing it. And there might have been different things running through different people's minds. Some may very well have not understood that there was going to be a change in occupational disease relative to the workers' compensation system by virtue of that change in law. There may have been others who thought that that was, in fact, the case and that was a reason to oppose the bill. There may have been others who thought that was a reason to support it because it would be better for workers. And there may have been some who may have thought it would change occupational disease and supported the bill for that reason because they thought that employers might actually be better off in court because of the difficulty of proving negligence in order to prevail. I don't know. But I do know this. You mentioned the 1930s, and I'm looking at an almost 80-year-old letter that shows that there's absolutely nothing new under the sun on this issue. This is a letter from an asbestos manufacturer dated January 22nd, 1935. And it says, and this is 78 years ago, and a couple of weeks, I guess, and it says, the desirability of making various dust diseases. In 1935, we were talking about dust diseases. A manufacturer of asbestos was talking about dust diseases in 1935. The desirability of making various dust diseases compensable under properly drawn workmen's compensation laws was the subject matter of the memo. And it says, one of the speakers stated that the strongest bulwark against future disaster for industry is the enactment.
Senators, it's getting rather loud in here. If you have some conversations, please turn down the volume or go to the side or back galleries. Proceed, Senator.
Mr. President, thank you. It says the strongest bulwark against future disaster for industry is the enactment of properly drawn occupational disease legislation. Such legislation would first eliminate the jury and empower a medical board to pass upon the existence of the disease and the extent of the disability. Second, eliminate the shyster, and I quote shyster, lawyer, and the quack doctor, since fees would be strictly limited to the law or by the law. And third, permit the correcting of initial mistakes in the making of awards, which is to say juries that believe they were adequately compensating the victim or a hearing board or hearing officer or administrative law judge that believed they were adequately compensating the victim. Correcting those initial mistakes by providing for hearings to reduce or eliminate awards if proof could be adduced that the claimant was not disabled or the extent of his disability had been overestimated, and obviously in cases where subsequent evidence arises that might demonstrate that somebody has committed a fraud upon the court or otherwise attempted to cheat the system. That's something that was a serious concern 80 years ago, and it's a serious concern today. We have other laws to try to address that, and it's important that we have those safeguards against people trying to game the system. On the other hand, it's also extremely important that we have safeguards to make sure that victims who are exposed to occupational diseases, one of the most pernicious of which we have been aware of for at least 80 years, according to the manufacturers of the product in question, It's important that we have safeguards to make sure that those folks are adequately cared for. And I am just struck by the fact that almost 80 years after this letter was written, here we are talking about a change in the law in 2005 that was either intended or unintended, depending on whose point of view you adhere to or subscribe to. And now here in 2013, trying to take up how best to proceed given the state of the law in Missouri as we find it.
Well, you know, I'm looking at this. First of all, I admire your research skills, Senator. Going back so many years, that's quality work, in my opinion. I'm looking at a quote from our previous minority leader, and it's an article in the Post-Dispatch of March 17th, 2005. And, you know, he says, this is Senator Callahan, Governor Blunt and his cronies not only believe that there are areas within our state where only the worthy should live, but now they continue their assaults on the poor, the injured, and the disabled to the degree that we must question their motives. And then he says, you know, his advice to workers, do not get sick and do not get injured. It's kind of like what I said yesterday.
Well, and the other side of that quote from when we had the change in the law 8 years ago is, of course, the fact that now we are back pursuant to the notion that, in fact, the 2005 law didn't do enough to restrict the rights of injured workers or people that had occupational diseases, that it sent claims into the civil justice system that some believe should be addressed through workers' compensation. And so if Senator Callahan was disappointed in the change of the law that occurred in 2005, I would imagine he might be even more concerned about the fact that we are now working to correct, as you've termed it, the one mistake that it made in the minds of some.
Well, I'd like to thank you for the inquiry, Senator. I would also like to thank you for the information that you added to this conversation. I think it is worthwhile. Again, my interest in this is twofold, really. One, we need to be thoughtful in all of the legislation that we consider in this body, in this General Assembly, because we don't want to have to make mistakes. And it seems like there are a lot of mistakes that are being made. The way my constituent said it earlier, and I just wanted to use this, he said this is a legislative overdose to have occupational disease in this legislation. It's legislative overdose. It's an overdose. And from what the senator from the 13th said earlier, when this bill came out of committee, there was no occupational therapy included. It wasn't even included. So the rumor mill says because the sponsoring senator didn't want to have problems on the floor. I don't know. That's just the rumor mill. But here we are going all the way back to 1920, in 1930, discussing an issue that needs careful consideration. It is an overdose. And you know what happens when you overdose? You get whacked out. This is a whacked up piece of legislation right now. Whacked up. And I don't even understand how Missourians could tolerate whacked up jobs like this. How many times are we going to go back and clean up mistakes? Now, I've got to say, from 2005, I'm glad they made the mistake so that people for 85 years who didn't have an opportunity to become whole because of their occupational disease are now, today, they have the ability to become whole because of the mistake that the Republicans made in 2005. How many more mistakes? Maybe we should have more mistakes on their part to help us out. We didn't even see this. We didn't even see this happening. How many more mistakes are we going to be looking at now and in the future? What did we pass last year that that we're going to have to consider 2 years from now because they made a mistake, they didn't make a proper consideration, and they were not thorough in looking at this language.
Well,
how often does that have to happen?
That's what I've been trying to determine, and that's why I engaged in the inquiry I did earlier today. I don't take for granted that it was a mistake or not a mistake, and of course some view that the change in the statute really should not have warranted the change in the manner in which it was interpreted that ensued. And I've just been trying to get at that to understand where people are coming from or what they were thinking at the time they voted on the bill. Because it's one thing to say that you believe occupational disease should be in workers' compensation or outside of it. It's another thing to say that you thought it should be out in 2005 but back in 2013. And I will say so far I haven't heard anybody say that. I've heard them say that they had a different understanding of what they were voting on and didn't foresee how a court might interpret it. And I would say that, you know, that can happen. It's a legislative hazard. We obviously all work very hard to guard against changes in the law that might result in unforeseen interpretations or decisions, but it is an occupational hazard, and we all work very hard to make sure that mistakes don't happen, and you don't have to look too far back in time to see that despite the best efforts of all involved, unfortunately sometimes they do. But in this case, I was simply trying to discern what folks were thinking at the time.
Wanted to give you that. I haven't even, you know, given you all these quotes in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and the Missouri Lawyers Weekly, more St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and let's see, all these letters. I mean, we can go on because this supposedly was the legislation that was supposed to pass. This was going to fix the problem after 85 years. Supposed to fix the problem, but so for some reason we're here right now to fix a mistake. And again, I don't understand why occupational disease is under the consideration of second injury fund. If we are trying to approach this, and I said yesterday, the senator from the second, by increasing the caps, is moving in the right direction. If you recall that letter that I read earlier, you know, 5 years ago, this Mr. Boyd, who wrote this letter, he said exactly what would happen. He said that right now, prior to 2005, the second injury fund is financially viable. And then he said afterwards, it would be an intolerable ruin. He said this on March 29th, 2005. And where are we today on February 5th, 2013? Are we talking about intolerable ruin? Yes, we are. Because someone made it happen. It wasn't the four of us who voted against Senate Bill 1 and 130 in 2005. The majority of people who were in the House in 2005 who said this was great legislation.
Well, let me say, first of all, I appreciate the floor substitute that the bill sponsor brought this morning, the senator from the second. I think that it was really a very big step in the right direction. There are different ways that we can approach addressing the current insolvency of the second injury fund, but the floor substitute that he brought went a long way toward doing that, and I appreciate it. And I would like to think that the discussion that we had yesterday evening on the bill might have been helpful in leading to that process. After all, that's what we're here to do. And, you know, I realize there are differences of opinion on whether occupational disease and second injury fund should be linked together. I will tell you, I'm generally inclined to support the current amendment on the floor of the Senate from the 13th. That said, I also understand that there are some other people in the chamber who feel equally strongly that the two issues do need to be taken up together. The best reason I can speculate as to what the thinking might be on that would be because at the end of the day, what we're talking about here are all workplace injury and disease liabilities that may exist in one form or another, And sometimes when the when the patient is on the table, you have to look to other related topics in view of arriving at a holistic solution. And I understand that. I happen to disagree with it, but I do understand the rationale, or I do at least understand that rationale. There may be others. But that said, I think the purpose of what we're doing here is to try to be constructive in arriving at a solution that works for workers and for the companies that have to do business in our state.
Senator, I don't know how we're going to be constructive at this point if this is the biggest hang-up that some of us have. I mean, take this out, and then we could get down to business. That's what I'm saying. Take this out. Let's get down to business. Let's roll up our sleeves. Let's do the hard work. Let's go back home and be able to say with integrity that we did the hardest job, the best job that we could to make the best piece of legislation. But as far as I'm concerned, by having this language of occupational disease within this substitute right now, it's a hang-up. It's not going to help us to move forward. And I realize that people have a lot to say, and certainly folks know I have a lot to say. You know, I haven't even begun, for real. But this is not my issue. This is the senator from the 13th's issue. And I'm just trying to help you get edification on what happened in 2005, because I didn't even remember what happened in 2005, and the senator from the 11th didn't remember what happened in 2005. And if anything, I just want folks to know how they voted. The majority voted for a mistake that we're cleaning up right now, and then a few of us voted for something that we fundamentally believed was wrong. And I don't know how fast that legislation moved in 2005. I have a suspicion it went pretty quick. You know, now things go quicker. But when we're considering issues like this that hurt disabled folks and former military guys and women and all these people who are in vulnerable situations who want to work and have an opportunity, you know, just to take care of their families. You know, do I go back home when I send out my newsletter this Thursday? Do I put in the subject line, Senator Chappelle Nadal fixed a problem that the Republicans created? Do I put that in the subject line? I don't know. I didn't know I was supposed to fix other people's problems like this. I didn't know that we have errors in our legislation like this. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, when we have errors like this, we're not doing our job. We're not living up to the high expectations of all Missourians. So I'm just saying, if we're going to pass something that is so fundamentally important such as this, 2005, so plus seven, all these years, we've been dealing with workers' comp and occupational disease, and we're going to try to move swiftly through it and not recognize or acknowledge the mistakes that others have made. And believe me, you know, I make mistakes too. Everybody makes a mistake. They don't understand everything. But at least try to understand. At least make the effort to understand your mistakes. And at least own up to the mistakes that you made. Just own up to it. You made a mistake. That's why we're here. We're cleaning up your mistake. We're the cleanup crew. We're the cleanup crew. Cleaning up your mistake.
Well, certainly, to the extent Senate Bill 1 and 130 was signed by the governor about a week into March of 2005, that would suggest that it must have moved awfully quick through the legislative process. And in my brief review of the legislative history of that bill, there were quite a few amendments put on by the House, or at the very least taken up by the House. Maybe every last one of them was voted down. I didn't look at it in that careful detail. But my recollection from legislative history was that there was upwards of a dozen House amendments that were either put on or voted down, but certainly debated by the House. And then it was sent back over to the Senate and truly agreed, finally passed, and to the governor's desk and signed, a little bit farther into the legislative, 1 month farther in the legislative session than where we are standing here tonight this time around. So it had to have moved pretty quick, and I think that it may very well be the case that it just moved too quickly, and one wonders if it had not been propelled through the process as quickly as it was, whether the decision giving rise to or interpreting occupational disease to be out of workers' compensation might not have ever come to be, for worse or for better, depending on one's point of view on the subject matter. But the regardless, the only thing I would say is, if in fact a mistake was made 8 years ago and the consequences of that legislation were not contemplated or intended by those who supported it, and we've heard a few of them say that today, and I take them at their word, all I would say about that is that it's February, what, 5th?
It's my grandfather's birthday, actually.
Well, wish him a happy birthday. That's wonderful. All I would say is if a mistake was made because things moved too quickly in 2005, maybe with an eye toward what happened in the past, we really do want to be careful to the extent we move forward with this legislation this year to make sure that if we are in fact, as you say, fixing a mistake, that at least we fix it good and get it right, whatever that may look like. And there might be 34 different opinions on that question in this body, to say nothing of the body down the hall. I personally stand ready to work with anybody to try to get us back to a place in Missouri where we either have a second injury fund that is solvent or a second injury fund that is closed and an adequate means of redress being made available to those workers who otherwise would qualify to bring a second injury fund claim, while at the same time making sure that we are not unfair to the workers in our state who have contracted occupational diseases. And I, for one, support the Senator from the 13th Amendment to de-link the two topics in this bill. As you point out, occupational disease was not in the bill originally. It only came in on the committee substitute, and I'm not so sure that simply taking up second injury fund the way the sponsor filed it initially when he filed Senate Bill 1 wasn't the right way to go about doing it. I think that we've seen in the last hour or two that we've spent on the floor, maybe even 3 hours at this point, debating the senator's amendment, that in fact, if the chatter around the campfire that the concern was linking the two issues could protract debate, I think we've seen today that in fact it has. I'm not sure that that's in the best interests of the workers, as you point out, of the 18 workers in my district who currently have unpaid second injury fund judgments, untold numbers beyond that who have pending second injury fund claims, to say nothing of the people who will be second injury fund claimants at some time in the future, or who will nonetheless experience the workplace injuries that give rise to those claims. And it's for that reason that I really do think, in the interests of addressing the concerns of those folks and making sure that they are adequately compensated, that we cut to the chase, that we adopt the amendment, and pass the best second injury fund bill that we can. Now, that said, if the amendment is voted down, I will say to you that I will remain ready, willing, and able to do what we need to do here to make sure we get the best possible bill out, because I have a hunch that there is a pretty great determination
well, there should be a determination when you've created mistakes. My goodness. This is the Missouri Senate. You can go on.
Well, I was about to finish, and I think, and unfortunately, my train of thought has derailed.
I apologize.
That
was just
okay.
The black woman inside of me that just came out.
Well, I appreciate that. But please do wish your grandfather a happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. President.
Further discussion? Senator from the 14th, for what purpose do you rise? Senator from the 13th, do you yield? She does. Proceed.
Senator, I didn't know if you were ready to close out, and I wasn't, you know, Senator Stofer came in here late one time and missed the opportunity to amend a redistricting bill. I didn't want you to have that same look on your face that he had when he showed up late to the chamber. So are you done talking about this issue?
Yeah, I'd like to see. I'm not finished talking about this issue.
Okay, so that's why I stood up, because you got to be on it.
But I am pretty much there with this amendment. I will say this. This should not be in the bill. This doesn't just affect workers. While you were inquiring of the senator from the first, I was feeling bad about not having a memory of what went on in 2005, and I pulled out some old things. Are you familiar with where Maline Creek is?
Moline?
No, Maline.
No.
Okay. Maline Creek ends up in the southern part of my district, and it butts up to the northern part of the senator from the 5th district. And it runs along three old plants. One was a GAF plant, one was a CertainTeed plant, and the other one was a cement plant. Those plants, one plant had been there, the plant that made asbestos pipes had been there since the 20s, and it had had several owners. But to get to the chase of my statement, lots of folks that live just to the north of that plant, and I remember as a kid, I lived in Spanish Lake, but this was Bell Fountain Neighbors, and it's where I live now. It's very near where I live now. It was always dusty there. It was always dusty. And they do soil samples, and they didn't have the protection of the, like we do now, from the EPA and DNR. But when Maline Creek, they would dump right along the banks of Maline Creek. They'd have this big pile of asbestos pipes they didn't use. People would come get them and make yard decorations with them. They didn't know what it was. The extras were thrown on the banks of the creek. Can you imagine what happened in 93? Well, I can tell you what happened. It was all in Bell Fountain Neighbors and people's backyards, because we lost, I think, 7 or 8 homes down there, and they were like within blocks of this plant. But we had one family, they had a son and a daughter, and the daughter was 2 years ahead of me in high school. The son was 3 years ahead of me. He's a football player. He had flaming red hair. The dad got sick, and he died. He had asbestosis. 5 years later, mom got sick, and she died. And do you know both of those kids died before they were 45 from asbestosis? From, riding their bikes in the neighborhood. It was always dusty over there. It's always, you could write your name in the cars over there every day, no matter how many times they washed them. But it was a nice community. It was a little bedroom community that, it was one car garage and nice backyard where people went to play. But these people were victims of just living near the plant. They all contracted asbestosis and they died of mesothelioma, all four of them. None of them, I think the dad, I don't know, if he, I think he sold insurance. Mom didn't work. Her name was Laverne. She collected turtles, little ceramic turtles. She was a friend of my mother-in-law's. And the daughter didn't work. She was married and had a family. And I don't know what the son did, but they weren't in any industrial jobs. So it's not just the folks that worked with it every day or the wives that did their clothes. It was the people that lived near the plants and the people that were exposed from water runoff in these places. It just doesn't belong here. It's not fair. If we're going to fix this, let's fix it.
Senator, I held off. I thought someone else would actually stand up and talk, but I know how it goes sometimes.
But Senator, you're doing such a great job. Sometimes you should never mess with perfection.
That's how I think.
There you go. So never think that somebody else should do it if you're doing a good enough job.
But, okay, so we had this break, as you know, and I asked, I received. It's amazing when you ask, you receive. One of my constituents, who I think you know, came to my office. He's part of my new district. He has this Irish sound to him. So you know who I'm talking about. But he explained this history to me. And when I listened to him, Senator, and he was telling me the story about Bo and Tony, two people who had diseases and died within 6 and 10 months of trying to seek wholeness, if you will, for the damage that had been done to them after so many years of being in their respective industries. He said something that was really interesting to me. This is a very personal issue to you. And I know when there is an issue that I really care about and is in my heart, and, you know, there are very few things that I would fall on a sword for, but I know this issue is one of those most fundamental issues to you, because you've seen your friends and your comrades die because of the industry that you worked in for so long.
There were an awful lot of O's on that, so I'm not that old. But I did work in the industry for a long, long time. One of the lucky ones so far.
You are. But, you know, I think about the opportunity that, you know, in my life, the people who've meant a lot to me have been courageous older women. Like the Harriet Woods, like Willa Boiseau, which no one will ever know who she was. These people really mean a lot to me and what they stood for in our democratic process means a lot to me. So I literally and figuratively stand in their shoes. And I realize that there is a greater responsibility that I have when there are issues that come up that they fought very hard for or against. And to be here to have the honor and to have the opportunity to be in this chamber and not stand up for what my predecessors, the heroines of my life, stood for so many decades and generations, would be a travesty. I cannot ever think of a time where I could be in this body and there's an issue that comes up and I do nothing about it. So I tell people all the time I love the rules of the Senate because it makes you equal. And I just wanted to tell you that, Senator, because you're going to have to cut your teeth on an issue. And you're going to have to figure out what that issue is. And you're going to have to stand for something that you believe in and not waver on whatever that issue is. It's not up to me to decide. It is up to you to decide. But you have to define who you are and what you stand for, what you will tolerate and what you will not tolerate. And I just want to make sure that you know that this, and I know you know this, that this is an honor, this is a responsibility. We are responsible for over 170,000 people and constituents. I've been in your district, you've been in my district. We know what people are experiencing who live in poverty because we see it every single day.
Every day.
I just want you, Senator, I want you to define yourself for what you believe in and what is in your heart. You know, one of my mentors told me, she used to be the lieutenant governor, she used to be the senator from the district that I now serve. She told me that you can never go wrong if you follow your heart. And there will be people who tell you things that you should and should not do, but you can never, Senator from the 13th, you can never go wrong by following your heart. And I know how much this issue means to you. And I hope that you get the resolution that you desire. I really hope that you do, and I hope that you stand strong and stand your ground on what you believe in.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Further discussion. Senator from the 7th District, for what purpose do you rise?
Senator from the 10th.
Senator from the 10th District, do you yield?
I do.
Senator from Troy yields. Proceed.
Thank you, Senator, for taking my inquiry. we've heard a lot about this bill, and I feel very different than when we were a year ago this time debating issues like this in the House of Representatives. The Senator from the 14th mentioned that the rules provide us all with equal opportunity, and I have seen a big difference in this chamber in that. And some issues, I imagine, are going to be partisan issues. And as the Senator from the 1st talked about what happened in 2005 when this bill was before the body, then what the breakdown was. And I went ahead and took the liberty to pull the March 15, 2005 vote. And it was a partisan issue, with the exception of General Koster. General Koster was the only Republican who voted with the other Democrats to voted against this bill. And I am today listening to this debate and wondering if we're going to end up falling along partisan lines again. And I hope that's not the case. And as you being the most senior senator that we have on in our caucus.
That's not true. The senator,
from the
22nd from Jefferson County is my senior.
So,
I didn't mean to interrupt. But.
No, it's okay. I just... I wanted to talk just a moment about partisanship with an issue like this. And the reason why is because I imagine that there are many people who are, waiting for second injury fund awards that are members of both parties, that are Republicans and Democrats. There are members who are, there are citizens who suffer from mesothelioma that are both Republicans and Democrats. And as we in this chamber value each other as equals, I'm hoping that we will also value the citizens who are suffering in a way that would not be partisan. And I wanted to inquire of you with the history of this body that we don't normally break along those lines. And that's
well, and accurate. I appreciate that, Senator. I thought it was a very interesting observation from someone that there were folks that are in this chamber that were in the House in 2005, but no one in this chamber was in this chamber in 2005. And I guess that's just term limits, and it's politics in the state of Missouri right now. And so it's interesting that you were able to pull that and bring that information. And I do agree with you, Senator, that obviously our constituents are all over the place, Republican and Democrat. And it is my hope, too, Senator, that we would take a look at these issues on an issue-by-issue basis and not let it necessarily fall along partisan lines. And to that end, I'm excited that we've been able to have this debate and continue to have these discussions and hopefully get to a place where everyone can be happy with it.
Well, thank you, Senator. Mr. President, can I inquire of the Senator from the 11th?
Senator 11th, do you yield?
Yes, Mr. President.
He does. Proceed.
Senator, thank you for taking a moment to talk to me about this. When we look at markets and we talk about economies, we understand that there are different costs associated with different values. And anybody who would suggest that the value or the cost associated with an ailment like carpal tunnel syndrome would rise to the level and compare with the suffering of someone who has been diagnosed with mesothelioma
right.
and put them into the same category of compensation, I don't know how that logic matches up. And I believe that when we're trying to do the best with policy and be a body of good government, it helped me understand the other side's argument, because I can't get there on why mesothelioma would be treated the same as carpal tunnel syndrome.
Well, I think it's just cost. I think it's a matter of if someone is suffering from one of these occupational diseases, they can use the second injury fund as opposed to the unknown of going to a court and finding damages there. I think our businesses would like that predictability. The problem with that is life's not predictable. And we have set up rules in our state and our country where if someone feels like they have a grievance, they go to a court. And that includes a employee who feels like they need some compensation for the work they did from an employer. And, Senator, that was why I support this amendment more than the fact that we're helping workers, is the fact that since 2005, we've been doing this. And employees have sought their own redemption, I guess, or some type of compensation through the court, and they haven't always won.
Right.
Because you got to have the facts on your side when you go to the court. So I think that the folks that want to include this in...
So going through the civil court is no guarantee.
They make the assumption that the employee always wins in a court case, and they don't. They don't.
Because sometimes facts aren't on your side.
I'm sorry?
Sometimes facts are not on your side.
Right. And so that's why we can't take away this particular occupational disease, that classification, and have it not go to the courts. That's why I think this is really important. And I know you're inquiring me, a question to me, but
yeah, no.
It's really important because we do need to clean up the second injury fund. I mean, there's just no doubt about it. There's no doubt about this. The senator... The senator from the 14th, I mean, she read that letter, and that was clearly what happened. And we shouldn't make that same mistake again.
Well, you know, again, I want to thank the senator from the 2nd for taking on this issue.
Right.
Because we are in the minority in this chamber, and a super minority in both chambers. And for us to arrive at a solution to a problem that's grave to the constituents we represent, it's going to take the Republican leadership to make some of these changes. So for that, I'm appreciative.
I agree with you. And you know, the senator from the 2nd is the most senior member of the Senate, and he's taking on a tough task. And
I would say he looks it, but I'm not going to do
right,
that to him.
Right.
Well, again, we talked about who voted for it back in 2005. It was a partisan vote in the Senate then, with the exception of General Koster crossing lines. But it seems like today, what I've heard from most of the folks talking on the subject, that this is something that we must do. We must find a solution because there are 30,000 cases out there that are in limbo.
Right.
And I wish these were two separate issues.
Right.
Wish we could address the second injury fund and fix the solvency, and then talk about what should be under workman's comp. And again, I'm having a hard time finding why anybody of logic would determine that mesothelioma should be treated the same as carpal tunnel syndrome.
Well, I just
don't understand that.
I agree. I'm of that mind, too. And I think the senator from the 13th Amendment helps advance us trying to solve the problem with the second injury fund. And with that said, I think those who don't agree with you and I are trying to figure out the most cost-effective way to handle this problem, and that's why it's included.
Well,
I think we probably have the same thought that yes, being cost-effective is good, but when you're dealing with such terrible illness, and you an employee has the right to have a little bit of help with that, it goes beyond the dollars and cents.
Well, it reminds me of. I'm a big fan of The Daily Show and Jon Stewart, and I probably will reference him from time to time because I think that he's an honest newsman. And he had Chris Christie, Governor Chris Christie, on a couple weeks ago, and he was talking about hurricane funding relief for Sandy victims, and basically said, look, you know, when you want the money, it's a need, and when someone you disagree
right.
with wants the money, it's an entitlement. And he said, but if you are an individual who is diagnosed with terminal cancer, isn't that Hurricane Sandy for you?
Right.
And Governor Christie really didn't have a response for that. And I think that when we look at the suffering that a citizen with mesothelioma has to endure, to suggest that that somehow equates to the other workman comp issues is just...
Right, it doesn't seem to rise... The other stuff doesn't rise to that level, and it seems very short-sighted.
Right. I hope that this body will do the right thing and support the senator from the 13th Amendment and make this a good piece of legislation. All right. Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator. Thank you, Mr. President.
Further discussion. Senator from the 14th, what purpose do you rise?
President, I noticed the absence of a quorum.
An absence of a quorum has been noted. Sergeant in arms, duly note the Senate. A quorum has been established. Further discussion on the amendment. Senator from the Jefferson County District.
To inquire the senator from the 13th, briefly.
Senator from the 13th, you yield. She does. Proceed.
Thank you, Senator. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Senator?
Pretty good. I wanted to make a point that I don't think has been made yet tonight, and as an optimist and a pragmatic person, the language in the bill right now is the exact language that the governor has already vetoed.
It is.
And a point that Senator Callahan used to make, and Senator Gross when I first got here, and Senator Griesheimer is do we want to just sponsor a bill that gets vetoed, or do we want to come to some solution so we don't deal with the same thing year after year after year? To me, I think we need to find a solution that can get through to the governor's desk and have him sign. And that's why I support your amendment. Second injury fund, I think we're very close to an agreement there. But if we leave second injury fund along with the occupational disease and toxic exposure, what do we think is going to happen?
We're back to where we started.
Right. And I guess to, I don't want to say play around, but to include occupational disease on an issue as important as the second injury fund, when the courts may decide that they're just going to raise the tax on all the businesses in my district, I don't think is something to play around with.
I don't either, Senator. I really don't. If we leave it off, then I think we're genuinely, using the phrase from the senator from the 14th, genuinely working towards a resolution for this big broken problem we have.
And hopefully that's the direction we're moving. I don't think we're going to finish this bill tonight. My hope would be that when you close, that we would get 18 votes in favor of your amendment. If not, there are other avenues. I know we kicked around last year considering an enhanced benefit, still keeping mesothelioma within workers' comp, or within the moving it back into workers' comp, but adding an enhanced benefit for that. And I would hope that amendment's out there. And as the senator from the 15th always says, this is kabuki theater right now. We're just kind of dancing around with no real end in sight if the bill stays the way it is right now.
I agree, but I don't think that we will be. I think that cooler heads will prevail, Senator. I almost said that dreaded G word, but I didn't.
Don't accuse me of being one of those.
Well, you absolutely are, though.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, that was my two cents. I wanted to throw that in there, and I think it looks like we're to a point where we can at least close on your amendment. We're moving in the right direction, and if that passes, we're at one point. If it doesn't, there's other amendments
out
there.
Do you know, Senator, that if this amendment passes, I will be able to clear a lot of things off this desk.
Right.
I would be so excited to do that.
Yeah, you and I could go down in my office and celebrate. But, thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. President.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Senator, you're recognized to close.
Thank you, Mr. President. I close.
The Senator from the 13th has moved for the adoption of Senate Amendment Number 2 to Senate Substitute 1 to Senate Bill 1. As many are the in favor of that opinion shall prevail, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no.
No.
The noes appear to have it. The noes do have it. Senator from the 14th. I'm sorry, Senator.
I apologize.
Senator from the 15th, what purpose do you rise?
I have an amendment.
Please send your amendment forward. Madam Secretary, has the amendment been distributed, Senator? Seeing no objection, a waiver of the reading shall be granted. Senator, would you like to explain your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. President. back in 1993, in an effort to deal with the workers' comp system in our state and higher premiums and a lack of diversity in the marketplace, the General Assembly embarked on creating what has been now known as the Missouri Employers Mutual Insurance Company, which was a state-sponsored way of having an insurance company that filled the void in that market. Typically, if you're trying to address higher insurance rates, there's two ways a state would have traditionally done this. One is to do something like this. The other is tort reform. Well, we've done both, and the fact of the matter is we're now in a place where this company, which is a creature of this state, receives an unfair advantage over all the other insurance companies in the marketplace because of the system that was set up. And it's my belief that we need to begin the process of divesting ourselves of this state-sponsored anomaly now. The fact is, there's an analysis as to whether or not these are creatures of the state or not. They principally rely on whether the governor has the right to appoint. This certainly does. And it also receives the benefit since it's been created, it's received over $50 million in federal tax-exempt status that other insurance companies do not enjoy. The marketplace now is flush. If you were to take the actuarial best practice of having a 3-to-1 ratio on assets versus liabilities and were to liquidate the excess, there's $127 million that we could pump into GR that the taxpayers are entitled to, in my view. This amendment takes a little bit of a different approach, which is to say, we're not going to do that, but we're going to do what I think a lot of innovative governors have done with a lot of things that have been on, been sponsored by the state and subsidized by the state over the years. This would be to put this asset out on the market, get bids, and to sell it. It would continue to operate. It just wouldn't enjoy the benefits that no other workers' comp insurance company in our state benefits from. I'll give you a couple other advantages that Missouri Employers Mutual has. It had an initial loan of $5 million that it has since paid back. They do have the authorization to issue revenue bonds from time to time, not to exceed $40 million. Certainly other insurance companies in the marketplace do not have that ability. And as I mentioned, the over $50 million in tax-exempt benefits that they've received since their creation. There are now 332 companies in this marketplace.
16% of the market is now occupied, well, there's 332 companies that are in this space. The time has passed for this to be a something that the state needs to be involved in, and I want to begin that discussion. This bill was filed last year. We ended up with, and I'm going to inquire the senator from the second here in a second, with the idea that we were going to study this in the interim. Well, that never happened. At some point, when we all campaign and we talk about right-sizing state government, and we start talking about core government functions, we talk about coming up here and trying to do that stuff, at some point, we have to deal with some of these difficult issues. Because there's lobbyists that don't want this to go away. I get that. And I haven't even talked about, and this is not about some of the problems that this company has had with some of their personnel. That's not the reason to get rid of it. It's a black eye on Missouri Employers Mutual, but not a reason necessarily to get rid of it. But I think if you put this out on the open market, it fetches well in excess of, like I said, the $127 million that they're sitting on right now. They made no distributions to their shareholders. They did recently after the bill was filed, because that's, again, part of the analysis of whether or not this is a creature of the state or not. So they're one by one trying to pick away at that, because they know that they're operating in fantasy land here, and it's time for us to again, divest ourselves. So with that, Mr. President, I move for the adoption and would like to inquire the senator from the second.
The senator from the 15th has moved for the adoption of Senate Amendment Number 3 to Senate Substitute 1 to Senate Bill Number 1. Senator from the 2nd, do you yield to the inquiry of the senator?
Mr. President.
15th? He does. Proceed.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I did see mention this yesterday. I saw a Facebook post that yesterday you were in the suit that you were wearing when you graduated from college. Is that true?
That is correct. It was the first suit I had ever bought when I graduated college in 1995. And my wife became a personal trainer in January, and I'm her poster child, so I was able to fit into my first suit, and it was a little snug, especially in the arms and the chest. But
well, you look svelte. You look svelte.
You're
like
great,
you're a walking advertisement for
yes,
your wife now.
For Carissa Roop at Club Fitness in Wentzville, in case you're in that area. And
this is like OzarkWings.net.
Like OzarkWings.net. You're right.
So what do you think about this? Here's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to help you, you know.
Oh, yeah, you're doing a great job.
Thank you. And what I think is that if we're talking about and this is part of a broader discussion about that rate. So not only the size and scope of government, but that rate that we're dealing with now, we know that at some point if we get to this place here in this bill, the director is going to have to adjust that. And it's somewhere between 3% and 6% based on, I think, the most recent substitute you have. Boy, wouldn't we reduce the amount of whatever that rate would be if we were able to pump in $100+ million from a Missouri Employers Mutual company that we just simply don't need in this state anymore. How do you feel about that?
That sounds an awful lot like a corporate bailout, because you'd be selling MEM and then using the proceeds to pay off a liability of the business community. And I think you probably have a lot of opposition.
So you do, well, then maybe you support it. See, I believe this is a taxpayer asset. So maybe if it's not in this, you've got this bill. Hopefully it may go to your committee. We can get that money back.
I do believe this bill is in my committee.
What's that?
I do believe this bill is in my committee.
It was last year, too, wasn't it?
It was. Well, and you got a hearing last year.
I did.
We tried to pass that legislation. We passed it out of here.
Right.
They was going to do the study, the actuarial study, because obviously if you try to sell a company, what's it worth? We don't want to try to sell something like this on an amendment on a floor on another bill. This is something that really needs to be studied. We need to roll up our sleeves and dig down into the financials and see exactly what that company is worth.
Well, I agree. I know that we're trying to kill some time here. And
no, not really. We were earlier, but... Now
well, I wanted to begin the discussion.
Now we're just entertaining your bad idea.
I wanted to start the conversation on a great good government proposal that I'm going to withdraw the amendment, but I want us to start talking about
and
this.
And I look forward to hearing more about this in the Small Business and Insurance Committee.
Well, I look forward to that hearing.
Yeah, you know, my calendar in like early June is pretty free. So
well, I hope, Senator, I have so much respect for you. I hope, and I know that you have respect for all the taxpayers. that helped float this operation 20 years ago. I just want to get their money back.
I
want to get their money back. And I'd be okay with it being an income tax cut. We send that money back to people because they helped start this business that has no business being in business any longer.
I look forward to that hearing in the Small Business Committee.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. President.
Senator from the 15th.
Would you please send that amendment back?
Madam Secretary, please send the amendment back. Senator from the 13th, what purpose do you rise?
Been distributed. May I ask for a waiver of the reading?
Please send your amendment forward. Seeing no objection, a reading of the waiver shall be granted. Senator, would you like to explain your amendment?
Mr. President, this amendment carves out diseases, carves out asbestos diseases associated with or caused by asbestos exposure from the occupational diseases.
Have you moved for the adoption of the amendment?
Adoption.
Senator from the 13th has moved for the adoption of Senate Amendment Number 3 to Senate Substitute 1 to Senate Bill Number 1. Does any other senator desire to be heard? Senator from the 2nd, for what purpose do you rise?
I believe we've made a good amount of progress tonight. I'd like to ask that bill be laid over on the informal calendar with the amendment pending.
With the amendment pending, that bill shall be placed on the informal calendar. Senator from Newton.
Thank you, Mr. President. I would ask that you proceed to the call of the formal calendar.
Formal calendar, Senate bills for perfection. Senate bill number 7, the senator from Johnson County.
President, I move that Senate Bill number 7 be taken up for perfection.
You've heard the motion from the senator from Johnson. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The bill is before the body.
Thank you, Mr. President. I now move the adoption of the Senate Committee substitute for Senate Bill number 7. Senate Bill number 7 deals with school districts that have become unaccredited. In particular, what we're talking about is a Kansas City school district, which became unaccredited on January 1st, 2012. Currently under state statute, a school district can still stay in that status for 2 entire school years. So in this particular case, the Kansas City school district could still continue their operation until June 30th of 2014. Almost 2.5 years after the district became unaccredited. That's too long. And we have students who are languishing that need help, and we as a state need to come in and do that. Now, last year, this body acted and acted very responsibly and very quickly. And, in fact, we passed a bill almost identical to Senate Bill 7 that passed the Senate unanimously. And for those of you who are in the body tonight that were here last year, I want to thank you for your support. And for freshmen that are new here, I hope that you're able to support it as well, because I think it's so important that we will rush in and help the students in the Kansas City School District. Waiting until June 30th of 2014 to help with some advice and some a new start for these students has to happen very, very soon. This just didn't happen overnight, and we've been in this discussion for well over a year. And I want to thank my colleagues, primarily from the Kansas City area, who have worked so hard and have been a listening post and just have worked tirelessly in working with their constituents in the Kansas City area. The senators from the 7th, from the 10th, from the 9th, and the 11th. And they have just done some outstanding work in dealing with their constituents because this is their home. And obviously they want the best for the Kansas City School District that is possible. You know, a lot of my colleagues talk about education reform, and I think if we had a poll in this body, I think everyone would have a different definition of education reform. But if you're talking about real education reform and helping out a lot of students, this is the bill, Senate Bill 7, that will rush in and help our students very, very quickly to help out in this situation. So that's what it is, Senate Bill 7. Obviously, I think it's very important to get this bill through the process very quickly. It does have an emergency clause on that, so upon the governor's signature, the State Board of Education could act. They could, if they decided to, have a state-appointed board and to take a lot more responsibility to the Kansas City School District. Be glad to answer any questions, or if not, I renew my motion.
The senator from Johnson has moved for the adoption of Senate Committee Substitute to Senate Bill Number 7. Does any senator desire to be heard? Senator from the 9th was the first on her feet. For what purpose do you rise?
Thank you, Mr. President. To inquire of the senator from Johnson, please.
Senator from Johnson, do you yield?
I do.
He does. Proceed.
Thank you. Senator, I really want to thank you for the work you've done on this bill, not just, of course, this year, clearly all the work that had gone into it last year. As you know, when we talk about education, it happens to be a very difficult discussion, a very emotional discussion for a lot of folks as well. And I will say that it really has been a pleasure to work with you on this for the last year and a half, I guess. I shouldn't say 2 years yet. But also your willingness really to listen and to take into account the thoughts and the desires of not only the legislators, of course, from the Kansas City area, but as we bring those thoughts back from our constituencies to this chamber, and I really want to thank you for that. I think as you stated previously, there really is no opposition to this bill. Certainly there's no organized opposition to the bill. Most folks are either highly in support of it or may not necessarily support it, but certainly do not oppose it. So for that reason, I really hope the body would then vote this bill, you know, out of this chamber. I think last year it passed unanimously in the House, and was there one dissenting vote?
It passed unanimously in the Senate and overwhelming vote in the House.
Right. So, you know, again, here we are again. We know that the bill failed the last, I think, the final 2 hours of session last year, and, of course, that was an emotional time as well. So I look forward, really, to the passage of this bill so that we can get, you know, back to move forward, at least with educating kids, of course, in the Kansas City School District. So thank you for your leadership on it.
Well, thank you. And, Senator, you have worked tirelessly on this. When we basically had some indications that Kansas City might become unaccredited, the discussion started.
Right.
And you were right there in the middle. You were at every discussion. I remember last year when we would leave on Thursdays to go back home, your work was just starting.
Right.
And I remember one time I talked to you, and you were having meetings with your constituents on a Sunday night.
It was. Last week
Sunday night.
Last week at Well. And, in fact, I was late to the my brother's Super Bowl party and then late then to a friend's Super Bowl party because of a meeting that I was having at 3 that we thought went in by 4, and it certainly ended after 5:30. But you know, that's part of the job. I mean, clearly, if you want to do what's right and you want to be able to take into account, you know, the views and the discussion from all of your constituencies, sometimes that's what's required of us. But, you know, I think during committee process, there was an amendment that was wanted, of course, by our local school board. But I will say for those that may have had some trepidation at home, and I do at this point believe it was a much smaller minority that had even given some consideration maybe to the amendment. But the bill, for what they wanted in the amendment, the bill clearly already allows it. They were wanting there to be some consideration by DESE in the event that the test scores came back and were markedly improved from last year. Clearly, as we talked about in this bill, it eliminates a 2-year waiting period. So it allows DESE to come in if they so deem, but it also allows them
the
to wait. Yes, the possibility to wait until August already. So that's something that really was already allowed in this bill. And at that time when we talk about the amendment, clearly, you know, it really wasn't needed because they already have the flexibility to be able to do that with the bill. So, again, Senator, thank you.
Well, thank
really
you.
For your work. And thanks to my other colleagues as well for the work. You know, we had a very good working relationship on this bill. That's not to say that everybody gets exactly everything they want, but clearly that's a part of this process. So thank you.
Further discussion, the senator from the 8th has sprung to his feet. For what purpose do you rise?
Wish to inquire the senator from Johnson.
Senator from Johnson, do you yield? The senator from the 8th has asked for an inquiry from the senator from Johnson. Do you yield to this inquiry?
I do. I do yield.
He does. Proceed.
Senator, first I want to thank you for sponsoring this legislation and getting it out here so quickly this year.
Thank you.
I think it's a great bill. Kansas City School District, how long has it been provisionally or unaccredited? How many years, do you know?
It just became unaccredited on January 1st, 2012. Before that, it was provisionally unaccredited.
But when was the last time it was fully accredited? When was the last time the Kansas City School District was fully accredited?
I don't have the answer on that. I think it's been years since Kansas City
School District. 40, I've heard 50, I've heard, it's been decades.
Right.
Would that be safe
that
to say?
Right.
So I think at this point in juncture, it's imperative for us not to wait another two more years for those kids to be in a school district that is not fully accredited. So I applaud you for getting this out here, and I hope it leaves this body clean, and I hope the House picks it up and passes the emergency clause, and we get those kids into get them a board that will focus on improving their education and not continue to let them stay in an unaccredited school district.
Well, thank you. Now, your district, your senatorial district, I don't think has any part of the Kansas City School District.
It does not.
But it's close. And so the issues that we're dealing with is not just, I don't think, confined to Kansas City School District. It's the surrounding area and, of course, the whole state.
Here's what happens, though, is those students finally, a lot of times, some of them move into our districts. And
right.
They're behind. And they're not, and they, so they hurt students in my district, my school districts. And so I think it's the right thing to do to have everybody have an adequate education. And if they're not accredited and it hasn't been for decades, I think it's time for us to step in. I believe that the St. Louis situation looks positive, seeing that the state came in, took over, and moving in the right direction. So I want to see the same thing on our side of the state.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. President.
The senator from the newly formed 7th District of Kansas City, for what purpose do you rise?
To speak on the bill, Mr. President.
Proceed.
Mr. President, I rise in support of this legislation with a little bit of reservation. I want to start by saying that I believe that this bill is not an indictment of the current Kansas City, Missouri School Board. The school board in Kansas City is made up of good and decent, caring people who have done their best to try to take a very difficult situation and make the best of it. And I think that the district has arrived at the place and time where state intervention is necessary. And I have given this a lot of thought. This is not something that when I came to this chamber, I was indecision. I was laboring with my colleagues and with my constituents and with interest groups in the district. When the state intervenes in a local circumstance, it brings with it a lot of questions from the community. The first thing it does is it puts our students back in doubt, back in turmoil. They already live lives that have enough doubt. And that gets me to the point where I also believe that this piece of legislation is not going to solve the problem. The problem is not with the governance. While the governance changes, I believe, which is why I'm supporting this, can lead to a different result, the results that we've arrived at today are not because of the governance. And so we need to look at why the students are failing. And we need to look at the district in a way that doesn't blame the traditional suspects that the reform agenda wants to blame. I taught in the Kansas City, Missouri School District for 5 years before I was elected to the House. I got to know the district, the families, the students, the community, and the problems that they face are socioeconomic problems. They are problems of nutrition, they're problems of transient nature of unemployment, families, their problem with utility bills not being paid, their problems of not having what we would consider a nuclear structure sometimes with the two-parent household. Parental involvement is a problem in the school district. So when we really focus our attention and efforts on fixing that school district, I don't want anyone in this room to think that this bill is what's going to do it. This bill is a means to an end for significant change in the short run. But it's not going to address the inherent problems with failure. And I'm hopeful that as this session progresses, issues like the senator from Kevney's, senator from the 4th, who has an early childhood bill that would allow the districts to voluntarily have early childhood pre-K, and that would be in the foundation formula, so they don't have to fight over the grants and the appropriations process. And year after year, they know that by having that program from 3 to 5 year olds, the money is going to be available for that effort. That is the step that's going to solve the problem. And I want to have that dialogue. And I don't think that this bill is the time to have that dialogue. I'm looking forward. I'm hopeful that the senator from the Forest bill will be in our committee soon, and we can start that discussion, and then hopefully we'll have it in front of the body, moving it out of here to make it law. We'll have that discussion then. But I do think that it's time for a change. And I'm hopeful that the SAB will, if it is, if this is Nicastro's determination. And I also, with Senator Curls, was looking at an amendment that would delay Commissioner Nicastro's ability.
Senator?
Yes.
We refer to other senators on their floor by their district or the county they're from, not by their name.
Senator from the 9th, we want to see the district succeed. And the district is saying the data is headed in that direction. And that by August, by the MCIT 5 results, they're going to be provisionally accredited. I think that we owe it to the voters of Kansas City to give them that option. And that's a decision that we're now putting in the hands of Commissioner Nicastro. We are saying you are the top education official in our state. We are giving you the latitude to make that determination by supporting this piece of legislation here. And I am hopeful that she will take that opportunity to see the results that the current school board and the current superintendent have been proclaiming are headed our way. Because if they make the 70 points and they make provisional accreditation, then that means they're doing their job. And we need to give them that chance. So I support this piece of legislation tonight. I support a discussion for a larger view of what's wrong with an unaccredited school district. And I'm hopeful that Commissioner Nicastro will give the Kansas City, Missouri School District until August to see those results, to find out if intervention is truly necessary. It may be. And if it is, we'll support her in that effort. Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator from the 11th District, for what purpose do you rise?
Thank you, Mr. President. I'd like to inquire the Senator from Johnson.
Senator from Johnson, do you yield to an inquiry from the Senator from the 11th? He does. Proceed.
Senator, I also want to echo thanks for your hard work on this issue. I think the Senator from the 9th and Senator from the 7th and myself represent all of the Kansas City School District and the kids that go there. And this has been working on this for over a year, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then last year it was tied up with some other education issues. Is that right?
It passed the Senate unanimously.
But then wasn't done the last 2 hours of session, or
the House leadership made a deal, or they made an ultimatum rather, and said if we would pass a teacher tenure bill, they would pick up and pass this bill. And it was ready to go. It would have taken about 1 minute to do, and they refused to pick it up. And the senator from the 9th mentioned what a tough situation that was, to know they could have easily picked it up, could have easily had education reform, could have easily helped thousands of students in the Kansas City School District, and refused to do it. In my opinion, it was unconscionable. And when people start making deals and not looking at the student, and that's what we're here for.
Mm-hmm.
We're here for our future as well, for the state of Missouri. And so that's why it didn't pass last year.
Well, it's a new day. So hopefully we'll run, as you've moved quickly on this and you've worked hard on this early on. When it comes to this issue, I can't say enough about the persistence and the determination of the senator from the 9th to work for her district and the kids in her district, and the partnership that working with you on this issue has really been good to see as a new member here, and I hope we can get it through. The senator from the 7th really makes some really strong points, and I hope that you heard some of the things he said, is that as we advance this bill, this does not solve the problem in the Kansas City School District. We still have lots of issues to deal with, and I would hope that the way you've shown your commitment to the district so far, you'll be open to some of these other ideas. I'm sure you will be.
Well, absolutely. And when we're taking a look at legislation like this, we take a look at a statewide policy, but it's so important to listen to the senators who live there, who represent those constituents, and they're very, very much a part of the political process. It's not easy.
Right.
I mean, it's not easy. I mean, for me, it's a lot easier because when I go home, they're not necessarily my constituents.
Right.
I don't see them when I go to the store and to church and to ball games and things, but these guys do.
Well, I think the point for our region, and it was good that the senator from the 8th also spoke about this. This issue of the Kansas City School District is a regional issue. It's a state issue. It's an issue that we cannot leave these kids behind any longer. We have to take action. It hurts our economic growth in the Kansas City area. We're in a long discussion in the Ways and Means Committee about how do we compete with Kansas. Well, the way Kansas has beat us in the past is through good schools. Missouri needs to have the best schools, and the Kansas City School District is part of that. So this is an issue that deserves a lot of thought and a lot of attention from this body and this General Assembly, so I appreciate that. And I think it's so important we get your bill passed that I'm going to not offer my amendment that I have.
Oh, okay.
And, Senator, it's a really good one because, you know, one of the things...
I would expect nothing less.
In addition to some of the ideas that Senator from the 7th said, I think that what happens in the Kansas City School District is that we don't engage the public enough. We don't engage the public enough through the political process. The Kansas City School Board is elected every 4 years and a different timing than when the city elections are. City elections are, the general election for the Kansas City, in March, last week of March. School district does it 2 years on a cycle in April. So what happened last election, I don't know if you know the senator, there was an at-large Kansas City school board person that won on a write-in. There was one sub-district that the winner had 552 votes. The other ones were write-ins. So we don't even have enough people engaging and running for office, let alone people voting for office for the Kansas City School District because of the way it's set up. So my amendment that I would like to still pursue, just not with this bill, is that we change how the board is set up, when they're elected, where they're elected from, because that engages the public, and that's the real root of how we're going to solve the problem, because we're going to empower Kansas City to engage and solve the problem themselves. So,
well, Senator, I appreciate you not offering it tonight. I you have my word that if it's referred to the Education Committee, we'll hear it because I think it needs to be heard. Kansas City District is unique. Out of 524 districts, it is the only one that has 9 members as opposed to 7.
Uh-huh.
It's the only one that has the ward where you have to live in a certain area for, I believe, 6 out of the 9. The other 3 are voted large.
Right.
I remember a couple of years ago, there's an editorial in the Kansas City Star, and it was talking about who to vote for and what you almost needed a flow chart to figure
right.
out who they were and what areas they were representing. And
now we don't have candidates. We just have write-ins.
Yeah, you're right. Exactly.
So they don't have the incentive to engage the public. So I really appreciate you seeing that as an issue. Again, to echo what the senator from the 7th said, this idea isn't the end-all be-all. Senate Bill 7 isn't the end-all be-all of it, but it's an important enough issue that we need to talk about all the way through.
And you have students in the Kansas City School District in your district.
Yes, I do.
Right?
I have my district is the far eastern part of Kansas City, and then through Independence all the way to the county line.
Right.
So I have quite a few kids that we can't give up on, and the work we do here and the work you've done, I think, will help. And again, the persistence of the senator from the 9th, I think, will win the day, and we won't run into the problem we had last year. We'll we'll get it done and help these kids out.
Great. Thank you.
So thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. President.
Further discussion? Senator from the 24th District of St. Louis County, for what purpose do you rise?
To inquire the Senator from Johnson.
Senator from Johnson, do you yield?
I yield. I do.
He does. Proceed.
Good evening, Senator. I regret the fact that in these first 2 years and in these next 2 years, I didn't have the opportunity to serve in your committee. Yours is a very popular committee. I can't imagine the number of requests that our President Pro Tem received to serve on that committee.
Well, it affects every district, and we all are very passionate about education. You're right, so thank you.
Yeah, and, you know, it's we had an interesting previous 2 years in your space, in the education space. I don't think we made a whole lot of progress in too many different directions. But it doesn't mean that I'm not, I don't care, I'm not concerned. Like everyone here, for the most part, we've raised children through the system. I've also served in all different types of capacities with other schools. So, you know, I have a few questions here that I'm sorry I can't come to your committee to ask these questions. And,
okay.
But I'll start first with, in your opening remarks about the bill, you described this bill as a reform bill. So what I see reformed is simply the two-year waiting period. Is there more in this that I'm not recognizing correctly as reform?
Well, I think what this does, it gives the state the opportunity to come in and take over the Kansas City School District as opposed to waiting until it lapses on June 30th, 2014. It gives a new governance structure to the Kansas City School District, very similar to what we've seen in St. Louis.
Did that not exist before, this new governance structure?
It would allow that to happen much quicker.
So again,
why wait a day?
I don't disagree at all. But I just want to get a sense of the reforms, as I understand them to be, in Senate Bill 7 are simply reforming the timing that the DESE can take action.
If you recall my opening comments, I said everyone in this body has a different definition of reform. And to me, I think that is.
Okay.
I think we're changing the state statute to help these students and to help them as quickly as possible, and I think that is reforming education. Now, for you and for others, there might be other definitions and other things that want to be tried, but for me, it is.
Well, that's good. I think that I would be shocked if this bill does not, once again, receive unanimous support. I view what is happening in Senate Bill 7 is, as you just described, it's bringing the relief of the State Department sooner to the citizens of the 7th. And that's kind of how I see it. So, I mean, it is kind of shocking that this is a bill that would even be considered controversial in any way, or and ultimately maybe it's going to be leveraged again. Yesterday I spoke with you, and then later my office shared with your office some of the ideas that people had brought forward to me. And essentially, for those of you who aren't aware, some of the ideas there were to say, look, do we redefine unaccredited in a different way? And I think that's a good question to ask. The challenge with asking that question in the form of an amendment or adding it to this bill is that we don't know just how many people that would actually impact. So, I mean, again, I shared all these ideas with you. I don't know, I didn't hear back from you. Your staff didn't get back to my staff, but you did get these ideas, right?
Right.
Right, okay. So I just want to, you know, make everybody know that I'm not.
Right, and I certainly appreciate that.
Yeah,
I
appreciate that. So I'm standing up today to talk to you about these things because we didn't talk since yesterday when we got these things to you. So, but I understand that. I'm going to actually inquire the Senate of the 7th when we're done about the local school board. I appreciate his comments immensely. I'm curious to see what he's thinking. This idea of this board will be a special board, it'll be a five-member board, it'll be five people with one vote each. And I think we talked briefly yesterday about, well, why wouldn't there be a CEO of the board, or why wouldn't there be a chairperson of that five-person committee? Why wouldn't there be one person speaking for the benefit of the whole? It's just like, you know, you as the education committee chair, obviously you have a lot of power as a committee chair in terms of what's heard and not heard, but you have one vote like everybody else. You're the spokesperson for the committee. So I'm just curious, you're thinking in not asking this five-member board to name a CEO or chairperson. So why would that not be a good thing?
Well, currently under our school board system across the state, school board members
elect their leader among themselves. There's no prescribed way of doing that. Some do it on a rotational basis, some volunteer. Some people just flat out don't want to serve in that position. And so it's kind of taking it from that model. You know, I think every person should have one vote. Every person should be equal on that state appointed board. And more than likely, I think that those members should elect a leader among themselves.
So that's what
it's not prescribed in the legislation how they decide their leadership.
So what you would anticipate then is that they would amongst themselves name a chairperson.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Is that, again, I'm sorry that I don't know the details of your bill. So is that process in stat? I mean, does it say please go amongst yourselves, vote a leader? If it is, just tell me it is, and I don't have to see it.
I believe that's what it
okay.
is, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Because the idea, again, for the benefit of the other members, the idea that was brought to me was, and again, we look to the success of the State Appointed Board in St. Louis City. I mean, I think that's a template for an example of, hopefully, what happens in Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're doing in legislation, which, again, I intend to support, speeds the process by which that special board comes to be. But in St. Louis, we named one person as the person, and he had a board. But you know the gentleman, Rick Sell, I'm sure you spoke with him, met with him, and testified many times mm-hmm. in front of your committee.
Right.
And it took on, you know, he took on a special role that he played. And I think in no small amount of the success is due to his individual efforts. So, again, that
most
was one
of
the ideas.
Most of the discussion last year and then this year was to make sure that state-appointed board reflected the community
yep.
and that there was enough local involvement. So it says that no less than three will come from the actual school district boundaries.
Right.
Because what we didn't want to have was to have everyone from outside of the Kansas City area be on that state-appointed board.
And I think the idea of...
And that's important.
I think the idea, in my mind, it would be a very fortunate thing if... You know, the CEO of this special appointed board came from amongst those three people in the community. I think that would, you know, that would aid in its success.
And there's nothing in the legislation that refers to a title,
yep.
whether it's CEO or chairman or president or whatever other title.
It does say CEO.
It does not speak to that.
Does not speak to that.
It just talks about the makeup, the five members, and where they're from, and that they should reflect the community.
But it doesn't mandate that they name a chair.
Does not.
Okay. Again, that's just a difference. I think when you look to what happened in St. Louis, I think a lot of the credit goes to the fact that there was one point person. That I can see where we could have a difference of opinion. That's it for now. I'd like to, Mr. President, if I may.
Senator from the 24th.
I'd like to inquire the senator from the 7th.
Senator from the 7th, do you yield so the senator from Barrie can also get out?
I do.
He does. Proceed.
Senator, I appreciated your comments before. I got a couple things I'd like to hear more about. One specific to the bill, but one actually I'd like to go to first. And you alluded to this idea. You spoke of your personal experience and the concept of, you know, the realities of these children's lives.
Right.
Away from the kind of, what was your school day, like 8 to 3 kind of thing?
Yeah, I think I had to be there at 6:40. And I got out. I coached.
I mean, your students. Your students showed up at what? 7 o'clock? 7:30?
Yeah, 7. I think 7:15 was the bell, and they got out at 2:45.
And you said, you know, in those times that they're there, obviously, you know, you're all hands on board. You're doing everything you can to change these children's lives and their outcomes, and maybe make them successful.
And we did. And you know, I'll share a brief story of heartbreak. I had a young Latino student who was in my class, and he was a sophomore. This was a history, U.S. history class, and when he came in, he was ESL, but by the end of the year, he had made so many strides that I had chosen him to be the student of the year for my class, and I really thought that he had figured it out and that he was locked in and that he was going to be college bound, and I was really excited for him. And the second to last day of the school year, he comes into my room and he says, "Coach, I'm quitting school." And I said, "Why are you quitting school?" And he says, "Well, I got promoted at KFC
right.
To be a training manager, and it has health care,
along with it, and my family needs me to do this for our home. He was the man of the house there, 16 years old, and I tried to persuade him. I said, look, you know, I mean, you're going to make the, I think it's $11 an hour now, but when you're 25, your opportunities are going to be just, you know, devastated. So really think hard about this decision, and he said he would, and then his mom called me and said, thank you for trying to talk to him. However, we need the money. And so he ended up dropping out of school, and I never saw him again. And that was just an example.
I'm curious your thoughts as, because it's interesting, the previous senator from the 5th, similar to you, had been an educator in a failed school district. And a lot of times we got into these debates, and she would kind of get to this point where she'd say, look, you can do all these things you think that will make the educational outcome better, but until you change the socioeconomic reality of the students that populate these schools, that's the problem.
Well,
heard a little bit of that in your earlier discussion.
Let me take it one step further. We got some interesting numbers directly from the school district during this debate as we're trying to collect our information. One of the things was a disparity in the district. So there are three senators who represent parts of Kansas City, Missouri. Myself, the senator from the 11th, and the senator from the 9th. And they broke down our proportionment of the district. And what we found out, I think, is at the root of the problem. In my district, I have 2,600 students that attend the KCMO school district. The senator from the 11th has 2,900 students. The senator from the 9th has 12,000 students.
Doing really well in the numbers, by the way.
And in land acreage, so just the size, my district is 10,200 acres. Senator from the 11th is 7,500 acres, and the senator from the 9th is 14,900 acres. So you can see the area. Now, assessed land value. Senator from the 11th has $60 million in assessed land value. The senator from the 9th has $90 million in assessed land value, and my district has $600 million in assessed land value. So I have 10,000 acres, I have $600 million, and I have 2,600 students. If you drive through Kansas City, you will see that difference.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that until we get serious about making the types of investments necessary to change those numbers, it's going
to be... What does that mean?
Well, in Kansas City, in the last decade, we've got a new arena. We have invested in private dollars in the Kauffman Performing Arts Center. We're looking at the Bannister Mall redevelopment, and we talk about the land assemblage bill later in the session. That is a crucial part of the revitalization of Kansas City. And we haven't seen in the last decade the types of private money, the types of tax credit dollars make their way into the part of Kansas City that needs it the most.
And your idea would be that if the development were to occur, it would raise the assessed values of those properties, and you could tax them and then generate greater monies for the school district.
Well, and when we look at the funding part of this, it's hard because for a resident that lives in Brookside, and I talk to them, you know, just privately at the door, you know, we all know that when we run for these offices, we knock on, you know, I knocked on 5,000 doors during my campaign. So that's, you know, probably 3,000 separate conversations that I had. And the number one issue they wanted to talk about was, what are you going to do about the school district? When I asked them, what do you want to do about the school district? More often than not, a lot of the parents that I talked to had kids in private schools. And they said, we want our area to be our area. We want to see Brookside secede from the Kansas City, Missouri school district.
They want to stop funding the Kansas City school is what you're saying.
Yeah, they say, look, you know, we need our neighborhood schools to be our neighborhood schools. And what they don't understand is that the history of the district is such that 1985, they couldn't raise a levy for the school district, so the judge imposed a $4.95 levy on it, which we're still at today. That levy has not changed. And the nature of the segregated areas between East Detroit and West Detroit are such that if there was a movement, and I think that we are a region, we are a city, we need to stay focused on lifting everybody's boats. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what our effort needs to be. But If there was an attempt to divide the district up, there are parts of this district that simply do not have the value in the property to sustain themselves at all. And so you go down to 32nd Indiana, where Central High School is located, and you see a five-bedroom home that was built sometime in the late 30s, and that home is worth $17,000.
But, Senator, what I don't know these numbers, but of what is the Kansas City School District, what percentage of the funding is coming from the state and not from the local assessments?
Well, we have 495 for the property value assessment. So if we did the math, and I could get them for you.
Like in the city of St. Louis, for example, the cost per educating a child is about $16,000, and a significant.
Ours is high.
Yeah.
I think it's like $14,000.
But I don't know on your side of the state, but a significant percentage of the monies that go to St. Louis City Schools come from the state, not from necessarily the assessed value. So.
Right.
So my question is, so I would probably suggest, I don't know, maybe Kansas City's similar ratio. So if it's $14,000 to educate a child, they're getting $7,000 from the state. So, I mean, so do you think that more money that would come through higher assessed values would be the?
It's not more money. It's more opportunity. It's jobs. It's stability. It is taking and transforming dilapidated neighborhoods to where the murder rate isn't the number one focus on a student's mind. I mean, it's transforming a part of the city that is so desperately underinvested in.
I get that, but, and again, the senator that you didn't have an opportunity to serve with from the 5th would kind of say, well, the school stuff's the school stuff, and you can spend more money, and again, I think that this was in a pushback to people that want to really transform the way public education is delivered in all different types of ways.
Right.
She said, look, go ahead and do all your things, but these kids are still who they are. You know, they still have the same socioeconomic status that they have. I mean, her idea was to figure out a way to get these people to pull themselves up their economic lot in life.
Right.
So are you thinking the same thing?
Well, and I've kind of looked at it like this. You cannot fix a sick tree by trimming the branches.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to address the roots, or you've got to plant new seeds. And I think that we're at the point now with the Kansas Missouri School District where it's going to take time. It's going to probably take more time than the patience for where we're at right now since it's taken 40 years to get here. But with a piece of legislation like the Senator from the 4th, early childhood, I think that by time our kids that don't have either the parental involvement to, you know, in the reading levels, the vocabulary, the social norms, here's the big problem. This gets into like the philosophy of what's wrong with the circumstances. I was a product of the Blue Valley School District.
I'm sorry. Okay.
I was a product of the Blue Valley School District
Valley.
On the Kansas side.
Okay.
In Stillwell, Kansas.
And where did you live? Where did you live on the Kansas side when you were in that school district?
159th and basically, you know where Blue Valley High School is?
I don't yet.
Two houses down from that. So
you're Kansas City, Kansas?
No, I was in Overland Park, but Stillwell.
Overland Park, okay.
So the south part.
Now I understand.
And this is what, you know, growing up, kind of seeing, there's a social contract that exists among successful families. And the contract is very simple. The parents tell the children, do your homework.
Right.
Go to bed.
Right.
Be good in school, and you will have the life that I have. And I'm role modeling that life by providing you with a roof over your head and a car for us to transport in. And they see the social contract being met. So that way.
Do you think part of that social contract is to stay married?
Well, I don't want to. I don't know if I want to dip into morality on. Ultimately.
Because, I mean, you've probably seen the same numbers. I mean, if you told me that this child graduated from high school and grew up in a two-parent household, then I could say to you that the probability that child ended up in poverty is 1/8 of what it would be if the child didn't finish high school, which this is part of this conversation,
sure.
And grew up in a single-parent household. So I'm just—I mean, you introduced the concept of social contract,
right?
And you defined.
I would say. You could probably get a social scientist that could run some models, statistical models, that would demonstrate the probability of two-parent households have a higher success rate.
Success. I mean, no, I think it's been validated. It's not a question of.
And again, you know, I don't have those numbers. Now, I was not. My parents got divorced when I was 16 years old. So
mm-hmm.
I actually was in my sophomore year in high school when that all went down, mm-hmm. and me and my sister made it. So I don't know that it's a direct...
But the, again, we go back to the other side of the state, and we go back to the failed school district, and go back to the disparity in assessed valuations.
Right. I don't think that contract is being upheld in the socioeconomic
parts.
To the parent and the child. I think
parent-child contract. The parents are letting the children down?
I think that in the successful areas, the contract is being upheld by virtue of role model status. And when they see it around them, and their friends have their parents, and they're all a part of the same social culture, then it becomes instilled. They don't have anybody telling them that they're not supposed to go to college.
Right.
And so going to college isn't a conscious decision. It's something that they do. When you go into an area where that role model and that traditional success is void, then something has to fill that role model status.
That'd be...
Well, I mean, it varies from different parts of the community. I mean, sometimes you have working class communities that they see mom and dad working for $10, $12 an hour and not having health care.
Right.
So that's one level of the contract being fulfilled. And then you have some that have absentee parentism, and that's another level.
Senator, you mentioned before knocking doors, and that's a phenomenon. I tell people that state senate is the highest office one would hold where they actually do that, especially in densely populated areas like yours and mine. And I'm curious, you mentioned, you know, there are some houses that have a $20,000 assessed value. Now, did you happen to have a conversation, let's say a married couple with a second grader, that their economic constraints are such that they can't go to a private school? And our laws are such that they're really obligated to attend a district that, when you were campaigning, maybe had just gone unaccredited. What are they telling you? What do they want us to do?
I mean, being honest, there's some anger. I mean, there's some anger over if you're asking me if I ran into a family that could not afford a private school but had no choice other than to send their kid to
what's
now unaccredited.
Who are they angry at? Because this gets to my other, like, you spoke earlier about the local school board not being responsible necessarily.
Well, I think that they have a role to play in it, but I don't think that they are the cause of the failure.
No, I would concur, cannot in any way be the... But, I mean, so this couple that have this second grader, they're mad. Who are they mad at?
Well, and again, I have a very diverse, you know, I would say Kansas City, between myself and the senator from the 11th and the senator from the 9th, if you were to look at any particular part of our district, it's really diverse.
Senator, I would suggest to you that the district that I represented when I ran is more diverse than yours. Actually, it's more democratic than yours.
It's not more democratic than mine, I promise you that.
Well, it was almost 60.
I think mine's 68.
Well, maybe. Then I stand corrected. So I get the whole diversity. I understand that. So again, get back. So who are they mad at?
Well,
are they mad at the school board?
I think that... You know, and again, we all make choices of where we choose to live. And when we buy a home or we rent a home, we are assuming the obligations that go along with the community that we choose to live in. So where there is anger, I think that some of them feel trapped in the district.
They feel trapped.
I did hear the voucher argument. I did hear that. I did hear parents say, I wish I had a voucher to send my kid to that private school.
Say that often?
No, it wasn't widespread.
But it was those parents that had a child that was stuck.
It was, I did hear it. I more often than not heard, fix the district. You know, I more often heard not, we want a neighborhood school for our kids. Now, when I went down into, let's say, the north part of Midtown, that message changed. Because you don't have a lot of families there, there aren't a lot of that type of, it's more of a, upper mobile, older population down there. So, I mean, so just depending on where you want to discuss the part of the district.
Earlier in your first time you stood up, you talked about not blaming the local board, the board that exists. And right. I guess I learned, again, I really appreciate the debate because I learned earlier that, you know, that there's a chance that they become reaccredited in August. And what you're saying is before the SAB replaced them,
right.
Either appoint a board, a different alternative governance structure, or, and this is the point of one of the Fourth Amendment idea that was brought to me that I think is a pretty interesting one. This idea that the way that Senate Bill 7 is drafted today, one of the choices that DESE could make would be to say, let the local school board stay as it is.
Yeah. I like that option.
And in this instance, you like that option, I would think, maybe, because you think that in August they'll be reaccredited, maybe, and...
No, not necessarily.
Yeah, explain to me. Help me understand. So this is, I'm the parent of that second grader. I'm mad. Somebody right. on the school board has to be somewhat accountable on some level, not 100%, but something. And the DESE comes in and says, okay, we understand there's a problem. We're here. We're going to go with the same local school board. Do you think those parents say, okay, that's good change?
It would be presumptuous for me to try to put a perspective on what a constituent would say let me answer your question directly.
Yeah.
You know, while I taught in the KCMO School District for 5 years, I believe that gives me a primary, perhaps unique, perception and experience from which to address this issue. However, I do not believe that that makes me an educational expert to then determine what is the changes necessary. Now, I have my suggestions and ideas, but I do think that Commissioner Castro is an educational expert. And I do believe that she's been charged by being chosen by the governor, confirmed by this body, to be that leader for that decision-making process.
But the way that the bill is drafted today, it's clear that one of the options, the three options that she would have would be if the bill passes, to, you know, pass an SAB, I mean, to create a special appointed board, to create an alternative governance structure, or simply to allow the existing local school board to remain. Okay, now, the idea would be, with an amendment, would be to remove that third option. Now, that does not mean that Senator DeCastro can't look at who's populating that local school board and take some of those members and appoint them to either the SAB or to appoint them, some of them, to this alternative governance structure. I have two thoughts about leaving that kind of blanket option open to the Department of Education. And the first one is this, is that in St. Louis's instance, obviously it took 2 years to get there, and the local school board campaigned as hard as you can campaign to be allowed to stay intact. And to this day, they meet, you know. All these years later, they still come together. They resent the fact that they were replaced. And they don't buy in to what the new group is doing.
Which is an inherent risk of this
process. And so my thought is that maybe in Kansas's case, you have a lot of personal experience. And you have a perspective that suggests that it may just very well be that accreditation is reattained in a very short period of time. And if that, you know, if a district were to go in and out of accreditation over a 6-month period, a 1-year period, you can make sense of the idea that, you know, a duly elected school board, you know, that's the people's voice. But I think that actually, you know, leaving it in there in a situation where a district's not going to come quickly out of back to being reaccredited. The St. Louis example, it took a long time to get back to provisionally accredited status.
Right.
If this option were not made available to the Department of Education chair, then it wouldn't be so clear to local school board that this is something they could lobby and fight for. That's just my thought.
Well, you cannot blame a sub-governmental entity for fighting for its existence. I mean, they were elected in legal sanctioned elections to be the representative in the school board of the people of Kansas City District. So,
but now, when this bill becomes law, there will not be a 2-year waiting period, and they could lose that status.
They could.
They will.
And I am comfortable letting Commissioner DeCastro and her and the along with her board and her other experts that do this for a living, making the determination. Now, I have asked her, asked her in the hearing, I'm going to write a letter to her before it's over with, to wait until we get the exit five results back.
Senator, I really appreciate the inquiry. It's the first time we had a chance to speak. Hope it's not the last, and it was interesting and informative, and thank you. So, Mr. President, I'd like to
Senator from the 24th.
I'd like to reacquire this, is that a word? I mean, re-inquire? I'd like to inquire the Senator Johnson, please.
Senator from Johnson, the Senator from the 24th would like to re-inquire you. Do you yield?
I
He does. Proceed.
Senator, I appreciate the process that we have and the opportunity I've had in these last few minutes to talk about different aspects of this bill. I just want to say I'm going to sit down and we'll go forward. And I just want to say that that there are a lot of people outside of that committee that are very interested in issues involving education. And they're very interested in reforming the process, not reforming one aspect of this process. But really, I come at this from the perspective of that, the eyes of that second grader who's in an unaccredited district. If that were a second grader 10 years ago in St. Louis, they would have spent most of their K-12 life in an unaccredited school district with no options at all. They were very angry. These parents are probably very angry. All we're doing is we're allowing the institution that is public school education to come from the state into the local community and kind of take charge. And I think that very thing is a good thing. I think the two-year waiting period is a bad thing. But I think that's, you know, we have different definitions of reform. We have not, this will not make it any more likely that a district that clings to accreditation, back and forth around accreditation, unaccredited, the likelihood of those schools succeeding has not been enhanced, in my opinion, at all. So I think you're reforming a process within education as it exists today that should change. It should not be a two-year waiting period. But, you know, unfortunately, this will be the second General Assembly that I won't be able to serve with you, and maybe I'll petition the next General Assembly's president a little harder. But it doesn't mean that I'm not very interested in seeing, not just, we all speak about education and improving education. I personally come at this from those least in society. I'm most concerned not about necessarily the kids in my district, though I'm concerned, but I think they'll be okay. I come at this from that second grader that lives in a $20,000 house that parents have no options. And that second grader is locked in. And this will not improve their lot in life, in my opinion. So I thank you for the time and your patience. I'd appreciate next time, let's talk offline a little bit quicker and spend a little less time doing this. We keep our colleagues here late. But anyway, thanks for the inquiry.
Thank you, Senator.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Senator, you're recognized to close. The Senator from Johnson has renewed his motion for the adoption of Senate Committee Substitute to Senate Bill Number 7. As many are of the opinion that shall prevail, say aye. Those opposed, nay. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. Senator from Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. President. I now move that Senate Bill Number 7 be declared perfected and order printed.
The Senator from Johnson has moved that Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill Number 7 be declared perfected and ordered printed. Does any senator wish to be heard on that motion? Seeing none, Senator, you're recognized to close.
I close.
Senator from Johnson renews his motion that Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill Number 7 to be declared perfected and ordered printed. As many are of the opinion that motion shall prevail, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The bill is declared perfected and ordered printed. Senator from Newton.
Thank you, Mr. President. We'll go to the order of business of announcements.
Order of business of announcements. Announcements? Announcements. Oh, Senator from Johnson, for what purpose do you rise?
I do thank the Senator from 13th. I don't want to steal her thunder, but tomorrow is Wear Red Day in recognition of American Heart Month, and in particular, women who have suffered from heart disease. So, wear red tomorrow.
Wear red tomorrow. Announcements? Senator from Newton.
Mr. President, no further business coming for the body. I move the Senate stand adjourned under the rules.
You've heard the motion from the Senator from Newton. All those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The Senate shall stand adjourned under the rules.